Okay. Yeah, so tonight's topic, and for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be dealing with some of the, tonight's going to be Bishul Akum, next week we'll talk a little bit about Chalav Akum, Pat Akum, all sorts of extra gzerot, extra halachot that we have, pertaining to not necessarily food itself, but food that was manufactured or that was processed by non-Jews, and also all sorts of restrictions which Chazal placed on that. The first one, as I said, talking about tonight, was having wine. But the first one for tonight, we're talking about Bishul Akum, which loosely translates as food which was cooked by non-Jew. A little bit about the basis of the enactment, which foods are forbidden, the cases where it will be permitted as well. So, for those who have the book, probably a very small minority, you're welcome to follow along in the book. For those who don't, we have it up here on screen, off on page 61. I'm going to put everybody up on mute.
Just a second.
Okay, so yeah, everybody's on mute just so that we don't have the background noise. But if you have a question, you have what to say, just unmute yourself and speak away. So let's just put the screen up again. Yeah, okay, so we're starting off with the basis, with the source of the prohibition. We'll go to the Mishnah in Masechet Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah, which deals with a lot of the halachot pertaining to interaction with the non-Jewish world, and specifically now in terms of foods and things like that. So we have the Mishnah. Source number one, you can see it in front of you, the Mishnah on Daf Lamed Hayam and Bet. It tells us the Mishnah, V'elu dvarim shel goyim asurim, all certain items, certain things which belong to non-Jews, which are going to be prohibited for us to eat, maybe to get benefit from. Obviously, as the name of the Masechet suggests, so a lot of the things are going to be connected to Avodah Zarah, connected to idol worship, that's going to be forbidden. And that's going to be the source of some of these things as well. But what we're talking about tonight is not directly connected to Avodah Zarah, which, by the way, is important to bear in mind, because some of the prohibitions that we'll see when it comes to certain non-Jewish customs, I think one of the very first shirim that we had was about Chukat HaGoyim, and talking about, you know, copying non-Jewish customs, which might be forbidden under certain conditions. One of those is we had something which was sourced in idolatry or might lead to idolatry, so that would be forbidden. And so certain halachot which may no longer apply in a situation where we're talking about a society which is not idol worshippers. Over here, that's not to... let me how to do that. Is that better? Okay, should be able to see it a bit better now. And what I was saying is that these halachot apply are not connected to idolatry. So they would apply to any case where it's something which was cooked by non-Jews. It says, so these are things which we are forbidden to consume, but you wouldn't be forbidden from deriving any benefit from it, unlike idol worship or anything which was used for idolatry. You couldn't get any benefit. And the Gemara and the Mishnah lists chalav shechalav ogoy, so milk, we'll discuss next week, which is milk by non-Jew, and there was no Jew who was supervising, v'apat, also regarding bread, there's a gzera of pat akum, also regarding oil, v'ashemen shelahem. Regarding oil, it's interesting, the Gemara actually talks about it, and says this was a gzera which was rescinded. Right? This is something which was not accepted by the Tzibur, and the Beit Din, initially they forbade that, but then that was undone. But what concerns us tonight is the last one is ushlakot. Ushlakot, which means cooked foods. So cooked foods, which were cooked by non-Jews, are going to be forbidden for us to eat. The Gemara discusses what exactly is the source of it. Is it a Doraita prohibition or a Darabanan? The Gemara has a thought to say that maybe this is actually a Torah prohibition based on a pasuk, which you can see here in source number two. I'm not going to go through all of it inside, but really the conclusion of the Gemara is that actually no. This is not based on a pasuk. This is an Isud Rabbanan, Ukras Machta Ba'alma. That's the last line over there in the Gemara. It says, Elamid Rabbanan, Ukras Machta Ba'alma, meaning that we bring a pasuk to sort of support this idea, but it is a rabbinic decree. And the fact that Bishop Akiva is going to be Mid Rabbanan is going to be significant, because we'll see in cases which may not be clear-cut, cases where there may be one or more mitigating factors at play. So if we are dealing with a Din D'oraita, it's going to be much harder to be lenient. Whereas if we're dealing with a Din D'rabbanan, there's going to be a lot more room for leniency, because we have a principle. If we have something which is doubtful, if it's D'oraita, we are stringent. If it's D'rabbanan, we can be lenient. So we'll see later on as some of the different factors come together, knowing that this is an Issur D'rabbanan is going to be quite significant. So the first question to look at really is, why is it? Why do we have this gzera? Why do we have this decree? Why did Chazal see fit to say that any food which was cooked by a non-Jew, you can't eat? So just to make a by way of introduction, we're dealing here with food which is kosher. We're dealing with a case where you know that all the ingredients are kosher. You know that there's nothing, there's nothing suspect that's inside. So we think. If it's a situation where a non-Jew cooked food, which we know is non-kosher meat or has got trefot in it, so obviously that's forbidden from the Torah to eat. That is not Bishul Akum. Bishul Akum is talking about food which is kosher in the first instance, but it was cooked by a non-Jew. And we find in the Rishonim, we find two reasons that are brought for it. The first we see in Tosfot, and source number three. And this brings Rabbeinu Tam, I'll just read the line here, which is in bold, in the middle. He says, "Mitchila gazu alia mitam chatnut." And this is going to be the reason for many of these prohibitions that were listed in the Mishnah, a lot of these foods, which strictly speaking would have been kosher until Rabbanan came along and said, don't eat them. Because of chatnut, because there was a concern for intermarriage. You can say in a sense, this is maybe a very early form of social distancing. Right? It's a way of separating between the Jewish and the non-Jewish world in terms of this. When you cook food together, you eat together, it can lead to all sorts of social interaction, can lead to all sorts of friendliness, and can lead to intermarriage. And in order to prevent that concern, Chazal came and made this decree. That's one. It's one reason that we find. We find many of the Rishonim discuss it, which is quoted Tosfot. There is another reason, which you can see here in the Haggadot Oshri. Haggadot Oshri, another one of the Rishonim, on the Ashkenazi Rishonim writes. He quotes the Rashbam, who was another of the Balei Tosfot. Rashbam katav b'shem rabotenu de bishulei goyim nesa mishum gzela shema yachilenu goy davar tameh. He says, no, this has got nothing to do with social interaction or not. This is a safeguard to make sure that you only eat kosher food. This is what he says again. When we're talking about bishulei akum, we're talking about the food in our case, which is kosher. But we're worried that if you're going to go and you're going to accept food from the non-Jew who himself doesn't keep kosher and isn't stringent about these things, then maybe, without your knowledge, he'll put something in there which is non-kosher. And in order to avoid that, Chazal said, you can't eat it. So those are the two reasons that we find. And different Rishonim bring one or the other of those reasons. Rashi, quite interestingly, actually brings both. Rashi, if you have a look at his commentary on the Mishnah, he says, V'ashlakot kol davar shebishlo goy, afilu bekli ta'ol, i.e. anything that was cooked by a non-Jew, even if it was cooked in a kosher pot, this has all got to do with a safeguard against intermarriage. That's what Rashi says on the Mishnah. Later on in the Gemara, Rashi gives us the other reason. He says, there was the Gemara we discussed before, saying that it's an Issur D'Rabbanan. He says, "Shelo yeh Yisrael ragil etzlo b'machal uv'mishte." Why? V'yachilenu davar tameh. And there's a concern that he might come to eat something non-kosher. So Rashi actually brings both reasons. The Aruch HaShulchan gives an explanation why it is that Rashi had drawn both reasons. It says to distinguish between this halacha of Bishul Akum and one which we'll hopefully talk about next week, which is Pat Akum. When it comes to bread, actually Chazal were a little bit more lenient. And so it says the Aruch HaShulchan, when it comes to bread, the reason of that you might feed him something non-kosher wouldn't apply, because when you look at bread, you can see straight away exactly what the ingredients are and what's in it. That's obviously talking about the reality of the Aruch HaShulchan going back over many years. Nowadays, that's not the case. When everything is industrialized, there are many, many ingredients in bread that we don't see, and it could have non-kosher ingredients. But nonetheless, be that as it may, says the Aruch HaShulchan, therefore by bread, certain of these leniencies apply. And that's why Rashi had to give both reasons when it comes to Bishul Akum. But something interesting that the Poskim discuss, is there enough kamina between these two reasons? Whether we say that the reason is because we're worried about intermarriage, or it's because we're worried about that you might come to eat something non-kosher, what would be the practical difference, which reason we go by? And there is a practical difference. It's been discussed. They say, what about when it comes to a mumar? What about when it comes to a Jew who is not just doesn't keep anything, but is really, you know, is mumar le kol haTorah, somebody who is, you know, rebels against the Torah, he is, you know, defiant in all the mitzvot. Something which generally speaking today is not so commonplace. You know, if we talk about, you know, the average person who may not be completely observant, that wouldn't fit into this category of a mumma. But be that as it may, would the food which is cooked by somebody who's a mumma, would that be forbidden under this prohibition? So if you say the reason is we're worried about eating non-kosher food, so then there might be room to suggest, yes, well, he doesn't keep kosher, he doesn't know about it, he doesn't care about it, maybe he doesn't know about it, so maybe you would say he's included. If the problem is that we're worried about intermarriage, well, Jews are Jew, and prohibition there of intermarriage, and therefore that would be allowed. And most poskim say that yes, even if it's a mumad, the prohibition of bishul akum would not apply in that case, and you could still eat. So that's more or less in terms of the basic prohibition, in terms of the reasons why Chazal instituted this gezerah. Now let's talk a little bit about where and when it would apply and wouldn't apply. And there are two basic requirements in order for food to fit into this category of bishul akum. Maybe just before we say that, if this was going to include every food that there is, so you can think about the kashrut lists, and in Chutz La'aretz there's a lot more of a problem maybe than it might be in Israel, although in Israel you have problems as well, in terms of this. Anywhere where you don't have, you know, Jewish workers in the factory completely, you know, doing everything, supervising, you know, you have a mashkiach. We know that we have many foods which have a hechsher that are on the LBD list or on whichever list that it is. You don't have necessarily Jewish workers in the factory. You don't necessarily have a mashkiach there, you know, cooking the food. How can it be that there's so many foods that are allowed, which are cooked? So first of all, we'll look at the two basic categories. We'll see this is already going to exclude quite a lot. And beyond that, there may be some more leniencies as well. So first of all, we go back to the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah. In the same sugya, the Gemara tells us two versions. Here they marked as 1 and 2, and the Gemara doesn't actually say 1 and 2, but just for ease and clarity. So, Amarav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak, Amarav. Kol ha-ne'achal kumot shu chai, ein bo mishum bishulei nochlim, usura matniachi. So in Surah, which was one of the two great yeshivot in Babel, they learned as follows. They said any food which can be eaten as it is raw would not be subject to this prohibition of bishul akum. When Chazal came along and they made this gezerah, they didn't make it on all foods, they made it on cooked food. So any food which doesn't need to be cooked, you can think of lots of fruits and vegetables, maybe even once it has been cooked, the prohibition wouldn't apply. So let's say probably the easiest example comes to mind is a carrot. You can eat raw carrots, you might cook a carrot as well, but because you can eat it raw, that would not be under the prohibition. In a moment, we'll talk about where and when these rules apply. That's where things get sticky. Everybody agrees on the rule. The exact application is going to be quite tricky. But that's rule number one, that anything that can be eaten raw would not be subject to bishul akum. Rule number two, and we just quoted the first one from Surah, so Pumbedita, which was the other great yeshiva they taught us. They said, and you can see both of these are quoted in the name of Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchak Amarav. So it's quoted in the name of the same Amarav. And again, different traditions as to what his teaching was. Amarav, kol she'eino ne'achal al shulchan melachim, lapet bo tapat, ein bo mishum bishul akum. So he says, essentially, anything which is not a significant food. Right? The first one focused on the idea of cooking. The second one focused on the idea of the food itself. This phrase, which I'm sure many people have heard, ole al shulchan melachim, meaning it would be eaten on the table of kings. That is not going to be subject to the to the prohibition. I.e. anything which would not go on shulchan melachim, anything which is an insignificant food which kings would not serve, that would not be included. Only things which are significant food, which again goes going to be difficult to define. Sorry, did somebody ask? Okay, so those are the two rules. Those are two statements that are made in the Gemara. Tosfot tells us that actually we go by both, right? Tosfot on source number 13 says Pasak Rabbeinu Tam Dilchta Kani Trei Lishnei. We go by both of them, and therefore this is going to be a great leniency. Any food which either is not sort of significant in this way or could be eaten raw would not be subject to the problem of Bishul Akum. This is the way the Shulchan Aruch paskens. Sanctuary as well. We'll get into it a little bit later on, but there are a lot of machlokot between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama in Sfaradim and Ashkenazim when it comes to Bishul Akum. Sfaradim are the ones that are more machmir, that are more stringent on these halachot, based on the Shulchan Aruch. But this is accepted by the Shulchan Aruch that one of these two leniencies is enough. So let's look at them one by one and see how they work. So the first one we said nechal kumachuchai, something which is edible raw. So how do we define it? Who determines whether you can eat something raw? Does it go by, is it something subjective? Is it something which is objective? The Gemara has a little bit of a discussion about eggs, because in theory you could swallow a raw egg. Gemara talks about it in a few different places. Is that enough to say that there would be no Bishul Akum by eggs? The Beit Yosef says no, it's not called something which is eaten raw, because most people wouldn't eat it raw. And this is what the Aruch HaShulchan says, that in this is not something subjective, this is something objective. We go by the majority. This is what he says over here in source number 17. Davar pashutu, v'rinyan davar sheno ne'achal kumot shulchai, ochim achal rov b'nei adam. And you may have maybe one person who has a certain eccentric habit of eating whatever it is raw, even though nobody else would. That's not good enough. There we say, batla da'ato tzel kol adam. We say that we go by the majority. This is also something which is societal. And the Aruch HaShulchan says at the end here, he says, "Aval im medina achat ochla kshi chaya, umedina achelt enoch yuntalak mevushal eniftalen zel hazeh." If in one society, it is customary to eat raw fish, in another society it is not customary, or it's customary not to eat raw fish. So wherever you are, you go by that country. We don't say that is nullified to the other place in the world. And that example which I've just mentioned is an interesting discussion in the poskim. What about fish? Raw fish. Because we know that there are many people around the world who eat raw fish in the form of sushi. So there are, and there have been poskim who wanted to say that now that we have sushi, and now that you see that fish is eaten raw, then maybe you could argue that fish, we cross fish as a food which is no longer subject to Bishul Akum. The truth is that you could expand this. If you want to say that about fish, you could maybe say the same thing about meat. People eat raw meat. You have biltong, you have carpaccio, you have all sorts of things. You might want to argue, but most poskim will say, we have to be careful. We have to distinguish. We don't make such a blanket statement. Each type of food, each type of fish, each type of meat, you have to look at it by itself. There's a note here from Rav Eliezer Melamed of Pnina Alacha. And this is a sefer that's come out quite recently. He says of Yan Source 19, even though nowadays many people will eat certain types of raw fish, like sushi, and there are those that will eat raw meat. Kapacha doesn't mention biltong, but nonetheless, we still have the prohibition of Bishul Akum, which applies when it comes to meat, when it comes to fish. It's a different form of eating. It's really a different type of food. And he goes on and he explains that. He says regarding in the case of sushi itself, if we're talking about the fish which would be eaten raw, this is the last three lines. So he says, on number sushi atzmo, lamocha always muvushal. He says, even the rice is cooked, any sul bishulei goyim. He says that sushi itself is not considered under the prohibition. Since the primary food over there would be the fish, which is not cooked, which is raw. Also sushi and so there are lots of interesting questions that raises. Connect also to what bracha you would make. The minute that we say that the fish is the most significant, So then you would say that the bracha would actually be according to this would be shakol and not on the oras, but that is on the ras. That's a different topic for when we learn about sushi. In any event, so that's case number one about food which is raw. What now? The second condition we mentioned olal shulchan melachim, something which would be served at a king's table. Particularly today, we don't really have king's tables anymore. It's very difficult to define. You know, what is it and what, first of all, before we ask, you know, what foods qualify, what is this condition actually trying to say? And there are essentially two ways of understanding it. There's a book, and there's an article over here. Next one. Yeah. Chaim Jachto is a Rav in America, and he wrote an article about Bishul Akum, and he says like this. Most significant exception is that the food must be olal shulchan melachim, as we've discussed, suitable for a king's table. So this rule can be interpreted in two possible ways. The first way, the Chazon Ish, believes that it refers to food that is not of poor quality and would be eaten by a very wealthy person. In other words, you might say anything that a king would eat, when it says a king's table, it's referring to somebody who's important, somebody who's a dignitary, something that he would eat in his house, something he would eat for breakfast. The Chazon Ish ruled that canned sardines cooked by non-Jews were forbidden because the King of England eats sardines for breakfast. I don't know if the royal menu has changed, but that's what he said. And that understanding really would leave us with quite a difficult scenario because most foods would probably still fall into that category. He says, of, yeah, he continues, that Aruch HaShulchan seems to agree with the strict ruling of the Chazon Ish. Or Schwab notes that many of the great Rosh Hashiva of pre-war Eastern Europe actually ate sardines cooked by non-Jews, which would be against what the Chazon Ish is saying. And he says the practice of the Rosh Hashiva appears to be in accordance with Rav Soloveitchik's interpretation of the rule. And I think this is probably the way that the majority of poskim understand what it means, olal shulchan melachim. Rav Soloveitchik believes olal shulchan melachim means the food has to be suitable to be served at a state dinner. And it's not about the fact that the king himself would eat it in his personal capacity, but it would eat in his public capacity, something which would be served, which would be on the king's table when he's hosting dignitaries. And that would be another way of saying that it needs to be a significant food. Just to finish off, this is Rav Soloveitchik's interpretation, has great implications, as according to his approach, almost no canned food would be included in the Bishul Akum prohibition, because food served at a state dinner is cooked fresh. So then according to that, we would say that a significant food, you know, something which you would serve at a dinner, maybe which you would serve at a wedding, maybe is another way that we could think about it. That's something that would be included in this. But something that would never be served at these kind of functions, you know, something which is just a snack. One of the classic examples, and this is discussed a lot, is, you know, think about chips, or maybe crisps, you know, from potatoes, that according to most poskim, would not be olal shulchan melachim, and that's why many kosher agencies will give a hechsher to you know, Walker's plain salted crisps, things like that. You know, they were cooked by non-Jew, because that's not considered olal shulchan melachim. That's not considered a significant food. I mentioned at the beginning how a lot of this ties into the fact that it's the Rabbanan, and here's another place where we see how significant that is. There are a lot of cases, a lot of questions where it may be, you know, somewhat borderline, somewhat of a gray area, whether it is olal shulchan melachim or not. And then we'll take other mitigating factors into consideration. And with those things together, we might say that the food would be allowed. Here's another article in English, Rav Moshe Heinemann of Star K, which is another kosher agency in America, article aptly named Food Fit for a King. He says, the prohibition of Bishul Akum does not apply to foods that are not prestigious, would not be served at a king's table when hosting an official state dinner, such as baked beans or cornflakes. These foods are permitted because the person does not experience deep feelings of gratitude and appreciation when someone warms up a can of string beans. Again, right, the whole rationale behind this prohibition was that it's food which is being served, which is going to ultimately cause a kiruv levavot, a sort of a closeness of hearts, is going to increase social interaction, and it's going to ultimately lead to intermarriage. That's what Chazal were trying to prevent. And he says, therefore, cooking non-prestigious food would not bring on feelings of closeness between preparer and recipient. Any food not served at a wedding feast because it's not elegant would certainly not qualify for Bishul Akum. And then there's an interesting anecdote here. He says, the Star K asked the White House executive chef what the White House banquet policy is regarding use of canned products for state dinners. Specific question was regarding canned cranberry sauce. We also asked whether potato chips are served. The chef's response was, we would serve whatever the guest wants. However, we never serve potato chips, nor do we ever use canned goods. Everything is prepared fresh. So this is going to be one of the major leniencies when it comes to potato chips, or crisps, as we call them in this country. And also when it comes to canned goods, you know, canned vegetables and things like that, this is going to be one of the leniencies. There are going to be a number of other leniencies there as well, those things taken together. Let's look at a few of the other leniencies that do exist when it comes to Bishul Akum. The next one is regarding liquids, you know, tea, coffee, things like that, because you might think, you know, if a non-Jew prepares a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or something like that, that seemingly based on what we've learned so far, certainly can't be eaten raw. And you know, regarding Olei al Shulchan Melachim, so coffee is something which it's an important drink. You know, you meet most people for coffee, something like that. So that there might be room to say that's included. However, many poskim say when it comes to drinks, since the primary ingredient here is actually water, and the proof of that, again, a lot of these ideas are connected very much to Hilchot Brachot, as to what is the primary ingredient, what would be the bracha recited on such a food. That therefore, when it comes to tea and coffee, since water is the primary ingredient, there would be no concern of Bishul Akum, according to many poskim. That's what Rav Avadia writes in Yechaveh Da'at as well. Okay. The next thing to talk about, and this is again going back to maybe the factories that we mentioned, also going back to restaurants. You know, I mentioned that a lot of these leniencies may exist in Chutz La'aretz, but in Israel you have a problem as well. You know, many restaurants, probably most restaurants, you know, you'll go to in Israel, in this country, and often the kitchen staff, the cooks, etc., won't be Jewish. And the question is, and there is certainly food there which can't be eaten raw. Food which would be significant, Olei al Shulchan Melachim, the fact that it's served in restaurants and people pay a lot of money for it is probably proof enough of that. Is there still a leniency? Is there still a way out of it? And the answer is there is a way out of it. And that is when the Jew participates in the cooking process. Going back to the Sugya of Avodah Zarah, Gemara tells us like this. This is quite a long Sugya and it can get somewhat complicated, but we'll just take the bottom line. So the Gemara of Yehuda Mashmuel, Hiniach Yisrael Basal Al Gabei Gechalim. The scenario the Gemara is talking about is you placed meat on the coals to cook. So the Jew placed it there. At the beginning, Uba Goy Vafach Bo, and the non-Jew came along and he turned the meat over. Again, this is going to be an action which is part of the cooking process, which is speeding up the cooking, which is, but it's a primary part of the cooking process, which the non-Jew is doing. Nonetheless, we're going to see, based on the fact that the Jew put it there in the first place and he was involved in the cooking process, that it's going to be allowed. Is it manami amarav v'achana amar b'yochanan ben sheniach goy v'afach yisrael ben sheniach yisrael v'afach goy muta? So the conclusion of the Gemara is whether the Jew was the one who placed the meat on the fire in the first instance, or whether the Jew was the one who came and turned over the meat to help the cooking. Either way, that would be permitted. It's only going to be forbidden as part of Bishul Akum when the complete cooking process was done by the non-Jew from beginning to end. Now, the question is, what do we mean when we say the complete cooking process? How much is it that the Jew actually has to be involved in, and then he has to have done? The Rambam over here, based on the Gemara, writes, as long as the Jew did a little bit of the cooking, a small part, whether it was at the beginning, whether it was at the end, as we've seen, so let's say he says, a non-Jew placed meat on the fire, or he placed the pot on the fire, and the Jew came and he turned it over, or he stirred the pot, or vice versa, that would be allowed. But you'll notice that in both the Rambam and the Gemara, what it spoke about was, where did the cooking process begin? When you place the food on the fire. Nobody spoke about just turning on the fire when there's no food involved. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch is going, Paskin's like the Rambam, and he says, in order for it to be considered that a Jew was part of the cooking process, it means he was part of the cooking process with the food. Put the food on, stirred it, turned over the meat, whatever it is. But what if the entire, that part of the cooking was done by the non-Jew, but the Jew was the one who came at the beginning and he turned on the fire, he stoked the coals, he turned on the oven, whatever it is. And the truth is, this is learned from the Gemara, which we may talk about next week, when it comes to Pat Akum, we mentioned, which is a separate gzera, which is a separate decree in of itself. When it comes to bread, that if there seems to be an indication that if a Jew had come and turned on the fire for bread, then that would not be considered bread of a non-Jew. That would be allowed. However, would this extend to cooking to Bishul Akum as well? The Beit Yosef quotes the Ram, who says not. Says over here in Bal Mashma that Lakata Ish Bilchud Lo Mahani. Is just lighting the fire would not be enough. Chenilam in Divrei Rashba. That's how he learns from the Rashba as well. And other Rishonim. He says, I'm just reading which is involved. Tzalich Sheitena Yodia Tamachvat L'Toch Hatanu. You need to be placing the pan into the oven itself. Lemakom Ha'Oil Basher Sham. Umashma Derefi Divrayim Kol Sheken Dechitoi Baru Lo Mahani. He says, therefore, just turning on the fire or just stoking the fire certainly would not help. And that's the position of the Beit Yosef. He brings many Rishonim who say that. The Dauke Moshe is more lenient. The Dauke Moshe says, actually, if it's just through stoking the coals or just turning on the fire, that is considered enough for it to be that a Jew is a part of the cooking process. And this is going to be a machloket between Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah when it comes to bottom line halacha. Source number 33 says the Shulchan Aruch, "En shkilat atanur mu'elet ela bepat." Says this idea of just lighting the fire, that's good enough that it wouldn't be pat akum when it comes to bread. Aval bishar mitbashlim with other cooked foods, en shkirat atanur v'lot lakata esh maleh mu'edet, it makes no difference, ela hanacha dafka. But it's only placing the food on the fire, it's only doing the actual cooking. The Ramah, here you see the Haggah, disagrees. He says, yesh chulkin usfer lud adlakata esh, ochitoy bagechalim mahani, lenyan bishuk mo lenyan pat v'chenu agin. He says, this is the minhag, that just turning on the fire, that would be enough. Later on, he says, he quotes another opinion, says, even if, you know, and this comes up, we have some of these industrial ovens, where they have a pilot light, where there was a fire, where even it was the non-Jew who lit the fire, but he lit it from a fire that a Jew had lit, says the Ramah, that would be allowed as well. That is a bit of a more far-reaching hetter, and we try not to rely on that if possible. But nonetheless, just in terms of lighting the fire, so that is going to be a machloket between Ashkenazim and Sfardim. And there are many restaurants which will rely on this opinion of the Ramah, rely on the lenient opinion. Sometimes, you know, when you have a tuda, or you have a heksha, and they'll say that, or you ask them about the standard of kashrut, and they'll say it's Bishul Yisrael Beit Yosef. That's a term people may have heard. A number of weeks ago, we discussed Chalak Beit Yosef, what that meant. But sometimes when you ask them, they'll say Bishul Yisrael Beit Yosef. So Bishul Yisrael Beit Yosef means that there is more, that they would be, the mashkiach would be responsible for making sure that he's turning on, not just turning on the fire, but doing, playing a more significant role in the cooking process. That would be okay even for Sfaradim. Ashkenazim, as I said, are more lenient about this based on the Ramah. Rav Avadia Yosef has an interesting tshuva where he says, because there are many establishments, many restaurants, many catering organizations where they do rely on the leniency of the Ramah. And Rav Avadia has a tshuva saying how could it be that Sfaradim could rely on this? And the truth is that when you read the whole tshuva, He's not advocating for tzedek hatchila. It's more of a limud zchut. It's more of a way of saying, you know, this is what people do. Is there any room to rely on? And he would also say that, yes, certainly Sfaradim should be more stringent in this regard. But if they're not, he says, there may be what to rely on. And he says as follows. I thought it was here, but it's a little bit later on. Around the leanings of the Ramah. So he says, like the Sezer of Avadia, he says, really, there's room to argue that this is a sveik sveika. We have a principle in halacha that says whenever there's a doubt, I mentioned earlier that a safek derabanan is lakula, that if we have a doubt in something which is derabanan, maybe we can be lenient. But he says, but when we have something where we have a double doubt, so that's something that we can permit. So he says we have a sfeika, that maybe it's actually permitted. How does he get to that? He says, again in bold, Shema halacha kaposkim asovrim shegam bishulei goyim itil besek al edei Yisrael. Right, so we've just seen a machloket between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama, which is based on a machloket rishonim, as to whether the fact that the Jew just lit the fire would be enough to allow it. So that's doubt number one. Says Rav Avadia, maybe the halacha is actually like those rishonim who the Rama rules. And he continues, if you want to say actually, well, maybe it's not, because we have another doubt. So this is something we haven't seen inside yet. But there is a discussion, and Tosfot talks about whether the prohibition of Bishul Akum applies only in the house or the premises of the non-Jew, or whether he brings an opinion that says that if it's in the Jew's house, then maybe it would be allowed. And he says furthermore that when and the Rama brings this as well, that where you have servants, or you might be able to expand this to employees that are working for the Jew, then it would be allowed as well. So he says, and that also is a machloket rishonim. So says Rav Avadia, Shema halacha k'omim shepoalim muskalim b'beit Yisrael yesh lakel. There may be those hired employees in the restaurants, wherever it is, because they're hired employees, that may be permitted. And taking those two doubts together, you might be able to say that it's actually allowed. He says, Afal pi sheshnei hasfekot em neged maran shekibanu hol ha'atav. Right? It sounds a bit of a stretch, because taking these two things together would be going against the Shulchan Aruch. And that's why he says at the end of the day, this is more of a limud zchut than anything else. It's not something he's eager for people to rely on in the first place. But for those who do, there may be that room to rely on. As I said, for Ashkenazim, it's less of a problem. One can be lenient, but one needs to know that at least that the fire was lit by the Jew in the first place, and that's part of the Mashgiach's job to make sure that's what's happening. If it happens, there's a power cut or it goes out or something, and the non-Jewish cook just decides, okay, he's just relighting the oven, so then that would be bishul akum according to everybody, and that would be a problem. In some places, Machon Somet in Israel has developed a sort of they call it a mashkichon electric, sort of an electric mashkich, where there's a certain system whereby if the fire goes out or the heat goes down, then there is it's locked, and there's an alert which is sent to the mashkiach's phone, and then no one else is able to technically relight it unless he comes along and does that. Another interesting question which has come up, and it's quite common as well, and this would apply also not just to the scenario we've spoken about in terms of restaurants and catering would be one scenario of Bishul Akum, where it's a question. Another place where it'd be a question is in people's houses. If somebody has a non-Jewish helper, you might think specifically in terms of when you have older people and maybe they have a non-Jewish helper who's cooking for them and who's doing all of that, you would still have a concern of Bishul Akum. And one of the places where there may be a lot of room to be lenient is what about in a microwave? Because when it comes to cooking, we haven't really discussed so much yet, but in fact, the Shulchan Aruch actually says that the type of cooking that was included in this decree is cooking with fire. There are certain types of ways of preparing food which are considered cooking for certain halachot. Certainly when it comes to Chot Shabbat, when it comes to Chot Batsar V'Chalav, we talk about different things. We've spoken about, for example, kavush. We say kavush kimvusha, something which is soaked, which is pickled, is considered as if it's cooked for certain halachot. Would that be the case for Bishul Akum as well? So the Shulchan Aruch says very clearly, no, it's not. Something which is salted, is that considered cooking? No, it's not. And over here, you see the Ramah says explicitly, lo asur ela bishul shel esh. When it comes to Bishul Akum, we're talking about cooking which was done by fire. Now, that could mean one of two things. It could mean cooking by fire because it's a significant type of cooking, i.e. these other things, sort of salting or smoking or different things are not considered significant. Or it could mean exactly as it sounds, fire, whatever is fire, that was included in the decree. Whatever is not fire is not. So when you get to a microwave, this becomes an interesting discussion. And there's a well-known machloket regarding a chot Shabbat. It's whether something which is cooked in a microwave is considered bishul or not. There's an argument between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Because over there, again, it's not through fire, strictly speaking. It's not through heat, which is applied from an outside source, but it's got to do with the waves which are eating up the food itself. Also, by induction cooking, we find a similar question as well. But so when it comes to a microwave, in terms of Bishulakum, Rav Vozna, Shevet HaLevi writes, he sees no reason to be to distinguish over here. He says that the reason for the gzerah would still apply, and it's a sort of a normal manner of cooking, and therefore he claims that this would still be part of the gzerah. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Weiss says no. He says on the one hand he's not giving a blanket heter to say that a microwave is not included in the prohibition of Bishulakum, but he says it's a bit more complicated than that. First of all, we say that it's not fire. And even more than that, it may not be considered sort of a significant form of cooking. And therefore, it's certainly, at least as a factor to add in, it would be something that we could consider a factor together with other things, that a microwave is not the proper form of cooking, certainly not fire. And therefore, in the case where, you know, somebody has a non-Jewish helper, cooking for them in their home, if they're elderly or they're ill, something like that. So we also have the fact that maybe, certainly if it's in a microwave, and we have the fact that that it's the person who's being employed inside the house of a Jew, which we saw there were some opinions who said that would be allowed as well. We may not rely on either one of those by itself, but together he says there's certainly place to be leaning. Final point maybe that we'll talk about and then we'll end off with this is whether the utensils require kashering. What happens if something was cooked, you know, you have a frying pan or you have your pot or whatever it was, and the food was cooked by a non-Jew? We know that any time we have non-kosher food, which is cooked in a pot, so the pot needs to be kasher. Over here, Chazal made exam, and many of the foods which we are not allowed to eat, many of the foods which are considered non-kosher is because they are derabanan. It's not not necessarily midoraita. And as we learned, going back a number of weeks, when we learned about kashering, really after 24 hours, once the taste has been absorbed for 24 hours, so there's no longer a Torah-level prohibition on the taste which is absorbed in those parts. On the Torah level, you would no longer have to kasher them, but midrabanan, you still do. And so, you know, if the question sounds a bit funny because this is only forbidden midrabanan in the first place, well, many of the things that we can't eat, most of the things that we have to kasher is because of drabanan. But nonetheless, this may be different because it's not the food itself which has something intrinsically non-kosher about it. It's just an extra gzera which Chazal made. And this is a machloket rishonim. The Torah quotes here the Rashba, who says, V'chen kelim shebishlu bayin avdei gilulim, dvorim sheyesh bayin mishum bishlei avdei gilulim, asurim. Says the Rashba that anything even though the food itself was kosher, but it's been cooked by a non-Jew, that would then make the pot itself non-kosher, would need to be re-kashered again. At the end, he says, the Tur, lo ne'el adoni avi arosh, the Tur, who was the son of the Rosh. So he quotes his father, who says he does not agree. Ketav she'en tzach lachush lezeklal, shlo echmil b'bishulei akum, le'esol plitato. He says, they only made a gzerah regarding the food itself, not the taste afterwards. So we have a machloket between the Rashba and the Rosh, whether these pots need to be kashered. Shulchan Aruch, and brings both opinions. He says in source number 48, "Kelim shebishabe magoy lefanenu dvarim sheshbe mishum bishule goyim." He says things which a non-Jew cooked in front of us, food which is prohibited for because of bishulakum. The reason he says in front of us is because if it wasn't in front of us, then we might have a concern that there were non-kosher ingredients added. So even though it was only kosher ingredients, shechim echsher. Because the pot does need to be kashered. And there are those who say that it does not require. And according to the way that we learn Shulchan Aruch, the principles, the Kalah Psika, that when he quotes two opinions, the first one is a stam. He just says, this is the opinion. And then he says, and there are those who say, so we go by the first opinion. And therefore, going by the Shulchan Aruch, we say they do require kashering. Nonetheless, this is on a lower level. It's not as stringent as the regular laws of kashering. And therefore, the notable exception is that if it was kli cheres, so it's earthenware, which generally speaking can't be kashered, in such a case, if this is the reason why it needs to be kashered, then it can be. You can do hagalah. He says you do hagalah three times, and then it would be and then it would be allowed. Okay, we will stop there. Next week, we're going to be talking about Hilchot Kadbaris.